Hello and welcome to a festive edition of Charity Pulse, your regular update on news and happenings in the charity sector. I'm James Saunders, a partner at Moore Kingston Smith, and I'm joined as ever by my co-hosts, Catherine Rudolph Rastomji, partner and head of charities at Shakespeare Martineau, and Charles, maybe Comet, maybe Cupid, Mosquito, charities director at Quilt Achieviot. You may be listening to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or YouTube or any of our respective organisations' websites. However you're listening, you're very welcome. But please don't forget to like and follow or subscribe, and generally, you know, whack on any positive feedback button you can find for us. Presuming, of course, you do find our little sessions useful in some way. We've got plenty of topics to cover this week, so we're going to dive straight in. I want to revisit HMRC and Gift Aid, which we have covered a couple of times in recent episodes, just to tie up where we are with it, really. We did suspect that HMRC had a bit of a project around Gift Aid, charity tax, all that sort of area. And they have now published a tax fraud court cases report saying that there's definitely, they described it as an uptick, can't stand that word, an increase in old-fashioned words, an increase in cases that are taken to civil courts around charity tax fraud court cases. But I mean, as we think, that might be a very, very small number to increase. And importantly, elsewhere in the report, there is a comment from HMRC that people do want to do the right things. Lots of the trends in gift aid are quite positive. Awareness is strong. And it is a small minority of instances of abuse that they found. So, you know, it covers both sides of the things, really. Yes, the charity fraud, terrorist tax fraud is happening, and it does happen, but it's quite remote. Catherine, do you want to start on this? I mean, we've spoken about this before, but anything particularly struck you about this?
Yeah, I just find it quite interesting because I think when we talk about gift aid, it does have a low take up generally. People say, you know, there's wasted funds that could be claimed in the gift aid and are not. And I just sometimes get worried that when we call this charity tax fraud, people get nervous about, are they able to claim gift aid? Should they be claiming gift aid? Should they be ticking that box? Whereas actually, this isn't a fraud against the charity, it's a fraud against HMRC. And I do think it's rare. So I think there's this whole education piece about we should be encouraging, you know, genuine donors, you know, that want to support charities. They should be able to make those donations and they are eligible for gift aid and should be claiming it. I just wonder if it has a bit of a knock on effect of making people a bit nervous about doing that and a bit reluctant, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there is a huge difference between ticking a wrong box accidentally or something along those lines, and the large-scale scam frauds deliberately defrauding HMRC with only the intent of raising money on it. So, yeah, that absolutely, that's a good point. Charles?
Yeah, I mean, so two things. I mean, you know, the Charity Finance Group has come out and it's calculated it's about $500 million a year of unreclaimed gift aid, genuine gift aid. And so therefore people shouldn't be put off. I think HMRC, and it's not in their nature, I know, just need to change this messaging. This has nothing to do with charities. This has all to do with individuals behaving inappropriately. This is straight fraud. This is no different to any other fraud. And we've just got to be very careful about tarnishing the reputation of the sector for people who are behaving badly, inappropriately, illegally, and the full force of the law should be taken against them. I mean, you know, putting a plea out for the HMRC to making sure that charities are diligent and doing what they're doing, but you know, they acknowledge that as you've already commented. So yeah, I just to my mind, what irritates me when I read these things is you get the headlines and then you look at it and you go, they haven't put any perspective around any of this. And they're actually pointing the finger in the wrong direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'd say we've covered a lot of this in previous episodes, but the official HMRC line is now out there. And I think it's quite interesting to read through what they've put out. A second story this week, then a number of linked stories, actually, that I wanted to flag, really. there's been a couple of stories about the charity retail sector. One saying that the sector has been earning lower profits this last year or so because of increases in costs, kind of understandably. And importantly, the income's been going up as well, but it's the increase in costs in particular that has really been stifling those profits in the charity retail shops and all those sort of activities. And then another series of articles talking about what the charity sector faces in terms of further cost increases because of the NIC increase. I mean, the figure has been put out by the charity sector leaders already of what the national insurance contributions increase will cost. But the result, of course, is fewer services, staff cuts. You know, the BBC had a feature on Mencap this week, I think Mencap Northern Ireland, but there is a very difficult, circle to work through here of where the costs are going up. Do you stop services? Do you fund them from reserves? Where are the local councils in all of this? So that's, a thorny issue at the moment. Again, Catherine, do you want to, any thoughts on that?
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think on the retail point, I think retail, as we know, is incredibly difficult, competitive, fast moving, not easy. So I think, and I think also there's a huge difference between charity shops. Some charity shops will be purely donated goods, others will be bought in, others will be a mix. I think the newer kind of type of charity shop is more of a community hub where there's a mix of, it's a facility for bringing people together to learn about the charity's activities, as well as the opportunity to support the charity. Maybe there's a cafe in there and things like that. So it's quite different, isn't it? And I suppose that mix of using volunteers, they have advantages over other retailers in some ways. But, I think it's tough. I think charities are being squeezed from a number of different places at the moment, whether that's
as well as those retail centres that you described. I think there was a story this week about one of the hospices has opened only brand new kit shop. So everything only with tickets. So that's the other end of the spectrum from the donated goods market. Charles.
Yeah, but they're not. My impression of that is they're not actually buying in. So there's a difference between buying in goods and selling it out, which is a direct competition. I think this was actually just recycling stuff that wasn't sold in stores. Stores are giving money to the charity shops. I assume as they're taking a bit of a tax break on that in the form of the donation when they're sold, I suspect. So that to me seems quite a commercial thing. I have to say there was part of me, and so I'm going to make myself very unpopular with the sector, who really didn't have much sympathy with this comment around the NI and the cost to shops, because these are commercial entities. And I agree with Catherine. I think these shops fulfill a much wider remit than just generating income for the charities. They are around raising awareness. They are showcasing the charity. They are the way of engaging with the public, and they are becoming much more community hubs. And as Catherine said, they have the ability to go and get volunteers to do it you're not paying NI on. So they have many advantages. So I think, to my mind, if the sector wants to raise the issue around cost of living crisis and minimum wage and NI, then focus it on your charitable activities, not on your commercial activities.
Okay. Having said that, there does seem to be a raft of charity closures being flagged at the moment. Relate this week and another Manchester charity going into administration. These are weekly events now of reasonable size charities just not being able to continue in operation. And the retail side can be a part of that. I mean, it's as you said, Charles, it's part of an overall picture. Well, yes, it is. But if that bit of an overall picture fails, they're not able to pick up any other new funding streams at the moment. And indeed, all those other funding streams are getting stripped out as well and reduced. So, yes, it's part of a bigger picture, but the bigger picture has to work as a whole, doesn't it?
I did say I make myself unpopular by making the comment, but I think there is a point there, and people should at least reflect on it rather than going no, this is because. The interesting with Relate, which used to be marriage guidance, from what I could read of that, that's more to do with government funding or lack of. And the one based up in Manchester was also similarly, I think, and they've gone into receivership, but it looks like they will come out again. But they were more of an umbrella body, weren't they?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I thought both of those stories were very interesting, actually, because, for instance, I've been seeing about, I think it's Forget Me Not Hospice had been saying they'd given notice of potential redundancies. And you think, yep, overnight, their national insurance costs have, you know, gone through the roof. Big impact. Whereas for Relate and GMCVO, the criticism seemed to be they'd known this was coming, that they knew there was a gap in their funding. They hadn't taken steps to cut their costs, and the lack of forewarning they'd given to their employees to be told just before Christmas you'd be made redundant. So I thought it's quite interesting that, you know, as a charity, but as an employer, you know, people do in a way have a different expectation, and, you know, the same challenges are there to run a business and diversify income stream and to keep an eye on overheads and expenses. And it just seemed that both of those charities, and they were, you know, decent sizes, hadn't done that.
Good. Third topic, Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy has unveiled plans for a place-based philanthropic strategy. And one of the things, just the biggest thing that struck me about, not the biggest, one of the things that struck me about this was that she said something nice about the previous government, which, you know, they're not supposed to do, are they? I don't think. I wondered whether it was sometime April the 1st when this was coming out, but no, it's the middle of December. Charles, what do you think about this? It's trying to link people's you know, contributions, philanthropy, to where they're from or their home base or anything like that. What do you think about all this?
I mean, look, because Orlando Fraser, chair of the Charity Commission, has also had been championing the whole thing around philanthropy. I think philanthropy, certainly, and encouraging people doing it, helping people to understand how they can set up charities or the different ways that they can get involved, I think would be good. I'm not convinced about the place-based. The place-based to me was to do with community foundations, and I'm not sure that, you know, particularly wealthy donors want to be restricted to a particular place. I think they want greater freedom than that. This is very much so down to their choice of what they want to do. And the other area, if government really wants to sort this out and make a difference, actually, they need to go to the FCA and they need to tell the FCA that those people who are advising around wills are actually trained and understand about the whole thing on charities and how to set them up and everything else. Because at the moment, we have a massive gap between people's knowledge of those that are advising on financial planning and the government, or previous to that, the Conservative government, wanting to encourage people to do philanthropy. So, you know, that would be an easy way to join a dotted line and make a difference.
Yeah. Catherine, you had some thoughts on the particular community foundations.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with Charles. I think it's a bit one-dimensional. It was a bit, you call it your fancy terminology that I'm not going to repeat, but actually you're just trying to link that with the community foundation network. And I would take issue with that, because I think donors need to be made aware of the choices available to them, that they could have a fund with a community foundation if they want, but there is a charge for that. And it varies between community foundations how much that is. I thought it was a bit one-dimensional to assume you want to restrict your charitable giving to a geographic postcode area rather than the causes and the things that matter to you over the course of your life. So I think there's more of a piece here around donor advised funds, around charitable foundations. It's much more accessible. Lifetime giving has, you know, much more of a benefit to the individual as well. So I just thought this was a little bit basic, but I also wondered if it was more of a link as well to some of the other comments from Lisa Nandy. I think with the Arts Council review, there kind of seems to be an implication about, is too much funding being in London and the southeast, and does that need to be spread across the country? So I just wondered if there's more of a focus there, perhaps.
I have to say, James, just as on being a trustee of a donor advised fund, PRISM, a gift fund, I'll give a pitch for PRISM because it does a fantastic job. But it never ceases to amaze me about how few people actually know what a donor advised fund is. I fully accept it's a ghastly name and it came out of the US, but they are fantastic vehicles. But Catherine's right, people need to weigh up the odds, the difference between setting up your own charity and what the advantages and disadvantages of that versus using a donor advised fund versus giving money straight to charities that are already in existence. And I mean, I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday on that very subject who's looking to give away, I don't know, 3 or 4 million quid, and just going to, but at the end of the day, it's going to be, you know, him and his wife's choice about what route they decide. All I was trying to do is just give them the information, and he'd never heard of donor advice fund. In fact, we're, you know, had to send him some information so that he had a time to consider it. So I think there is a massive opportunity and a knowledge gap that could be filled. And one, I think that, you know, if I was Lisa and Andy, that's what I would do rather than coming up with, as Catherine said, this wonderful heading or line for the press.
And again, given this is seems to hark back to what the previous government was doing, it does rather worry me that the first thing they come out with is as a new idea is not a new idea. It's something that someone else has done. But we'll see. We'll give them some time, I suppose. Final story is this rather unfortunate one about pugs. This charity that was set up for the benefit of pugs, but has been, it seems, sadly abused financially by its founders. And again, this links back to, you know, when we've looked at the Captain Tom Foundation recently, and just before that, the Naomi Campbell charity, where really it's governance, isn't it? It really is. There's two elements to this. Catherine, if you can cover the governance, and then Charles, you talk about the accounts, because I know that's got your goat. But Catherine, start with the governance. General governance here just seems to be, you know, it's non-existent, is it?
I know, and I think it's what's so disappointing is the way that people, in this case, I think brazenly are manipulating charity to benefit themselves. So here, the mum and her son, you know, the son gets a £7,000 Rolex watch paid for by the charity. You know, what is going on? And I think the same, Naomi Campbell, I think that was disappointing. I don't know if she was badly advised, but it's people getting involved thinking it's about them and what they can take from the charity, and whether that's ego, reputation, a knighthood, who knows what. I mean, I did love this one just for the comedy factor that it was the Muffin Pug Rescue, and the founder had a great name, Christine Lovelady. Thought I'd like to be Catherine Lovelady. Thought that was quite nice. And also a colleague of mine, I'll give a shout out, Deborah Burton, is very good at coming up with comedy headlines. So she said this was the pugly side of charity.
Yeah, great. Very clever. Charles, you spotted it. I mean, the original inquiry was launched because of their failure to submit accounts, which is, you know, an admin failure, rather than anyone really finding out anything, you know, heinously wrong before the admin failure came about. What do you think about it?
Well, I mean, but if you actually look on the Charity Commission website, I would really commend anybody who's going to give any money to any charity, just go and have a look up. I mean, you know, 2019, their report and accounts was over 1,100 and 2 days late. And the thing is, 2020, there was over 700 days late. And in 2021, it was over 350 days late. I mean, this is telltale signs. I mean, it would appear, looking at the report, they didn't even have auditors or accountants to do their accounts for them. And there was also a county court judgment in there. Mm. I mean, what worries me, I have to say, is one, obviously, late accounts, which is a good way for the commission to be picking up on charities not behaving or not doing things appropriately. There must be a cutoff point where the accounts aren't submitted and they haven't told the commission why they haven't been submitted. And there will be some exceptional circumstances with certain organisations. James, you'll be better placed to do that, where actually they should start looking at this more diligently, because, you know, this has gone on a long time before they do their review, and then their review takes time, and you've got these two founding trustees who are still in control of the bank account, and still behaving badly. The other question, which doesn't come out on the report, which I found really worrying, is that you've got three other trustees. What on earth were they doing? And I don't want to bash trustees because I don't want to discourage people from doing it, but this is just common sense. Sorry, if it doesn't smell right, if you think that if this hits the press in the Daily Mail or wherever it may be, that you're not going to be able to justify it and walk down the street and hold your head high, then you know that something's fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, I mean, for a substantial amount of this time, they were the only trustees, weren't they? The two, I mean, there were some trustees before.
But they had trustees before that had resigned.
They did. I mean, I would imagine those trustees probably threw up their hands and said, you can't do this.
Did they report that to the commission?
Well,
if they did, then what did the commission do about it? Sorry, this to me is just, you've got late reports and you've got trustees resigning. And assuming those trustees have told the commission why they've resigned, they may not have done. And if they didn't, then ask them question why. But if they did, then why isn't this being escalated into, because these are quite substantial figures that are being banded around.
I think that's fair. I mean, you've got to look at the timeline. You know, trustees, the charity started 2015, trustees appointed, trustees spent three trustees spent 2 and 4 years respectively in post, and the charity commission opened that compliance case in 2021 in response to the accounts submission failures, not because anyone blew the whistle, for example. They've got valid points there about the existence.
And James, I don't want to bash the commission, because I think the commission does a really difficult job, and I think fundamentally on the whole, I think they do a really good job with the resources that they've got. But I do think there are occasions, and we had it with the Captain Tom's daughter and son-in-law. You know, it doesn't appear that those that were trustees that were independent of them have not been really questioned of what's going on. And the other thing with this, which really got my goat, was that the current trustees are responsible for taking reasonable steps to recover property and money lost. I mean, why isn't the commission doing that? It's really difficult for a trustee to go, how much money should we spend to engage a lawyer to go after this money? Because you could end up spending the whole lot you've got, and then you're going to be blamed by everybody who gave you the money, which were there for pugs.
Yeah, I agree. Get a decent lawyer and a decent accountant involved, and you've probably eaten up most of that money, haven't you, Catherine?
Never.
That is probably all we've got time for this week. Thank you both very much. We've covered an awful lot of ground. Thank you also to listeners for tuning in to this episode of Charity Pulse. Hope you found the discussion insightful. If you've got any ideas, questions, topics for future episodes, please do let us know. Whether you're a charity professional, a passionate volunteer, or simply someone who cares about making a difference, we aim to make sure there's something here for you to listen to in every couple of weeks. So don't forget, please follow us, leave a review, share our podcast with your network, and join us next time as we continue to explore the challenges and the opportunities facing charities, nonprofits, and voluntary organisations. So thanks and bye-bye for now.